Welcome to Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. I'm your host, Celine Diaris, and with me today is Carol Sanford. Carol is a Senior Fellow of Social Innovation at Babson College and also the best-selling and award-winning author of 5 books, one of which I am a very big fan of, this one called Regenerative Business. Babson College has the distinction of being the number one graduate school for entrepreneurship in the United States, as ranked by U.S. News and World Report. That is very impressive.
I agree. They're amazing. It's one of the reasons when they offered me this idea of senior fellow, which you don't get paid for, by the way, but you have an intimate relationship with the ability to influence how education is happening and business. So I'm impressed with what they're doing.
Well, I think that's really excellent, and I'm excited to know that someone with your perspective is having that type of influence on how we're thinking about business, which is going to be a lot about what we talk about today. I want to just also express with full disclosure, I'm a student of Carol's in her CAD, which we'll just mention briefly what that program is, and very honored to have you today, Carol.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. So why don't we just briefly, just as I made that sharing, why don't you just give a quick short synopsis of what your Seeds community is all about and what students like myself are engaged in?
I work with corporations, but they can be large and small, which have leaders who are pretty unhappy with business as usual, but don't exactly know how to go about doing otherwise, and the change agents who want to support them making that clear and work in a better way. So CAD is the change agent development community, which are filled with people who want to work with organizations, individuals, using a regenerative / developmental paradigm about how we bring about change so that we don't borrow all the business as usual practices in the name of trying to do something good.
Excellent. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Definitely fits the way and why I am there. So Carol, I think interestingly, regenerative is a term that is gaining invisibility after probably a long time with your experience of orchestrating a lot of deep thought around what does regenerative mean and what are the deeper principles informing a true regenerative process. I'd like to talk a little bit about what is that for you as we look at this emergence of the term regenerative, how it's being utilized both in to describe an agricultural system and then the business overlay, like what does it mean in the business context? So I'm not asking you to tell me what it means in the agricultural sector. I can speak a little to that in our conversation. But I'd love for you to illuminate, because I say to people often, regenerative defies being defined as a specific series of practices or processes. That in fact starts to violate the very intention, forgive me, of what regenerative is. Could you speak to that larger understanding and insight of what regenerative means and why we need to safeguard it on a principle-based story as opposed to a practice-based story?
I love that question. It is an ancient idea. I've been working with the concept for 43 years, and the way I define it to make it kind of graspable in modern times is only living systems can regenerate. There is no possibility of regenerating something that is not alive. It has a beingness. It has an exchange with and engaged in a community. And that community can be either soil and biota all the way up to humans, which are engaging. So you have to start with, if you're using the term regenerative in a non-living system, then you're not regenerating. You've just borrowed the term. I've seen people even do it with agriculture, where they describe what they're doing as less harmful practices and are not yet on the way to regeneration. And I'm always a little bothered for two reasons. One, what Earth is missing, what they're missing, what the world misses when you just rename what you're doing. But I developed through the upbringing with my grandfather, which is going to be in my new book, a lot of this story about where the seven first principles I developed that people can assess whether or not they're there. Let me speak to just three of them, because it takes quite a while to do all of them. One of them is that it's always working with a whole. So if it's an agricultural field, it's a watershed. And it may be a sub-watershed, but it would be how nature defines a whole, and with the whole of the people who work in that system. You're not working with soil separately from, or with produce separately from, you're working with the whole of something. In a business, same is true. You have to be working with the whole of a business, and I often take it to the whole of a market, sometimes to an industry, because that's one of the definitions of being alive. You are whole until you're not, and then we put you in something, whether it's decomposing in soil or a box.
So I want to just interrupt you real quickly, because I want you to just also let us know that who your grandfather was, because I think the fact that these principles are coming from one of the First Nations is significant.
So my grandparents on my mother's side are both 50% Mohawk, part of the Iroquois Nation. And my grandfather, his mother left his father left the reservation shortly before he was born. And I grew up being imbued with, is the word that comes to me right now, a way of experiencing what it meant to rebirth the Mohawk Nation, which had been put into reservations at that time and were killing all of the process. They were being colonized. And my grandfather was chartered by his father to help keep it alive. And although I have no quantum blood that can claim Mohawk, my grandfather and grandmother can. And so these came from living with my grandfather, not all the time, but long periods of time, engaging with his farming, his raising pigs. He was a permaculturist before we knew the term, because that's an indigenous view. So that's, his name is Noble, which I always love.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. So just to return back to that first principle, we're talking about whole systems, which are coming from this deeper context, informed by a long-standing tradition in a native culture.
Yeah, and it's in other traditions besides, mine comes through that practice, but I later became a part of lineages that are spiritual, all of which have a similar idea, and they're based on the idea of each person must do their own regeneration. And so the only other two I wanted to list as principles, or to note as principles, help define that it's not just a whole, but each living whole has an essence. It is distinctive. It is itself. There is nothing about it that's borrowed, copied, can be categorized, and so it can't be made generic. And that's part of why when you say you can't define it, there is nothing generic if it's regeneration. It's always each individual whole with its unique essence. And coming to understand that as an individual, which I do work in helping people reveal what that is for them, would say, kind of know. But if you're running an organization or sharing it in the world, you want it to become more obvious. And we do that with a corporation. It helps define so many things. And then the last of the seven, the number three of the seven, although I don't quite have them in this order, it's about evolving capacity. So if you ever think about what you're doing is using it, or doing something to it, then you're probably not working regeneratively. Because if you aren't looking at each field of corn, each child, each market, and saying, how do we engage with it, not in a transactional way, not even in a do less harm way, not even trying to give it something new, but increasing its capacity to do for itself. to be able to express its own essence. And so if you're using the word regenerative, you should only be defining it based on a whole that has a unique essence it's seeking to express into the world, and that your work is to help evolve the capacity to do that. That's the shortest version I can give. There are four more, which I can't even remember where they're in the regenerative business. I know they're in the regenerative life, which is out shortly.
I appreciate that very much, Carol, because I think what is of challenge is how bringing a more reductionistically trained populace to start to lean into this notion of something that holistic, something that also is in service to the essence of a place, the essence of a person, the essence of an industry or a business, and then how you are striving to improve the capacity of that to be more of what it is.
Okay, I want to change one word.
Perfect.
It's not improve. Because improve is a human thing. We get to look at it and say, we can improve it. I use the word evolve capacity because it knows what, together we can determine how to evolve.
Right.
So words matter in the
They do.
Direction. Yeah.
You Thank are you the mistress of those words and they're mattering. Okay, so I just want to briefly share a little bit about what I witnessed happening in the regenerative agricultural community and have you make some remarks about what you hear around that.
Right.
So there are multiple schools of thought running around presently. There are those using the term regenerative with the intention of fostering a more holistic approach to how agriculture is being practiced. And there is a lot of intelligence with that simply because right now, most agricultural practices are highly destructive. Yeah. And to start to expand the thought process around what is going to be restorative, regenerative at an agricultural level, the term regenerative has really risen as a significant concept. So then you get into what is regenerative agriculture, and this is where some of the defining components start to arise. And there are many of us in the community saying, you know, we really need to be place-based, we need to be context-based in order to apply principles that they themselves become the pathway to a regenerative outcome in agriculture. Of course, this flies in the face of discomfort for a lot of us because we're used to having clear steps that we follow to get from where we are to where we want to be.
Right.
How would you add insight to this community around what would be principles that they could apply or a thought practice that they could utilize to lead them to a better query for determining how to make regenerative agriculture in place realizable?
Well, for one thing, I believe that people who are asking those questions have incredibly good intentions. And they're my favorite people to work with because they're questioning, because they're discovering, they're trying to figure out how to work on it. And I think the first shift that has to be made, and you said this in a slightly different form, is it's not about learning the practices. What are the best practices? It is about shifting the mind that asks the question. Because if the mind that asks the question says, what am I going to do with caring for the land? You were already fragmented. You're not working with a whole because the mind tends to start to make lists. So watch your mind when it starts to make lists of things that should be worked on. So if there is, well, we've got to make sure we pay attention to the soil and biota, you can do that and be in what I call a do-good paradigm, which is not quite a regenerative paradigm, or a less harm paradigm, which is just below that. So you've got to ask the question, which mind is working? Is the one who wants to see this as a living whole thing versus a human and what we could do to it that would reduce the harm humans do? That's a very big first shift that is fundamentally what I work on. And it takes capability to be able to do that. And that's why we have, as you said, we have the CAD, the change agent community, how I work with businesses, is that I first start getting them to look at the paradigm. Learning to assess where we are is the second thing you have to do with mine. So I've written a lot about that. There are kind of four paradigms, it seems, that work in the world right now. And we have to assess ourselves all the time. What am I speaking from? What do my words represent? The base one is extract or seek a value return. We know that one because it's much more transactional. It's much more what the business as usual is. I put money in, I should get something out. Because of that paradigm, a second level paradigm, which has arisen in the last 40, 50 years, is the do less harm, arrest disorder, where we keep feeling like, it, rightfully so, that we have to waste less, use less, recycle, reuse, reinvest, and certainly keep getting closer. And that's where restorative starts to come in, where we're trying to restore something back to its original working form, like a forest or something. That's not, again, quite too regenerative, but it's at a paradigm that's better than extract value. And no one would say, you know, you shouldn't do that. Then I have many clients, Jeffrey Hollander loves saying, when he first met me, he was talking about doing less harm and he suddenly realized he needed to do good. Well, I have disabuse him of that was the highest paradigm after a little while, which he just announced again last week.
Jeffrey Hollander is the founder of Seventh Generation, yeah. Just for those who don't know Jeffrey.
And also the founder of
American Sustainable Business Council.
Right, which yes. is one of your sponsors also. And B-Lab, I mean, he has been a moving, inspiring leader for me as well, but I got to work with him for many years and still do stay connected. All right, so moving from the arrest disorder to do good sounds like it'd be perfect, right? Okay, it's true. We can't just do less harm. We should do good. And the first time Jeffrey said that, he looked at me, he said, I got a feeling I didn't get that right. And I said, well, again, it feels better, but think about all of the nations, the peoples, First Nations on this planet who we went to do good by taking their children away, telling them they couldn't speak their language, putting them in reservations. All of the things in the world that have caused some of the greatest harm have come from the intention of doing good because we project what we think onto them.
I just want to pause right there, Carol, for a moment, because I think that is an extraordinary acknowledgement.
Yeah.
The tendency of all of us is to think that our perspective, that our observation is the right observation, the right perceiving. And to leap to the place that my essence is unique to me, your essence is unique to you. The beauty of that is that when we come together, we are more than we are apart. But I am not an authority over you, nor are you an authority over me. And the beauty of really deepening into the understanding that if we were to perceive our living world as a collection of an extraordinary amount of unique essences yeah. that are in a continuum of engagement and interaction and flow, that
and co-creation.
Thank you. It would be a profound shift in how we start to co-create in our shared reality. And it would then make such things as you were just describing, when we think to do good, we go and colonize, or we go and, you know, our religious tenets or our political tenets become the overarching good that we then overlay without true witness of the uniqueness of that person, place, and what's needed.
So one of the questions you ask, and I want to just wrap back to what we're working on, is what would I give as a way to think about or a way to work on agriculture? And what I'm the thing is, first, I think it's a mind that's at work, and we've been describing a mind called the do-good mind, or the arrest disorder, restorative, resilient mind, And we've been feeling really good about ourselves because we're not the business as usual extract value, but we're not to what a living system needs from us. That's why I created the seven first principles, so people had a reference about what it would look like at a regenerative paradigm. And I think that's what I want most, is people to become reflective, have frameworks and let them judge for themselves. You know, they always come to me and say, is this or that? And I said, let me teach you again how to think about it. I don't answer questions about what something is. I don't affirm whether you're on target or not, because that's some other mind that says there's an expert. So that's generally, oh, there's one other thing I wanted to offer. Place-based is one of the lowest levels you can enter. It's not the highest, and that's what we're used to. It is place-sourced that we want, because place-based means it's our place and that's where we're based. Place-sourced means we come to understand the place, its story, its history, how everything there is unfolding and co-creating, and we let it tell us what it needs. So I have a hierarchy that has, you know, location, on top of that becomes place connected and place care, and then becomes place based. And only when you get to regenerative are you place sourced. And I learned that from Regenesis Group, who does story of place so that people can come to see it as alive. So again, more about the mind and which paradigm is at work.
So you know, it's interesting because I know when I sort of leaned into the work that I'm doing currently with At the Epicenter, it's really sort of the expression of something that came to me in my 20s when I was living in Washington, D.C. I was studying to get a master's at George Washington University, and I had this kind of satori where it was like, you know, change is actually not going to happen from a policy level or anything that's coming from the top and trying to change what's below it. Yeah. What my recognition was is like, it's only when we shift our own perceiving as an individual and then have that filter into the way that we are organized into organizations and institutions and families and communities, that the true type of change that my heart wanted to see is even potentialized.
Yeah.
And so, so, you know, what excites me in this conversation with you is that we're really getting down to the core, which is it's how we think, it's how we label and name, it's the power of language and words, and the clarity of acknowledging to a certain degree a level of mystery and almost a surrendering to how much we don't actually understand and know.
I really agree with that. And I say to my students, I teach at three universities. And then my opening offering to them is three things. The first one is, don't trust me. Don't think I'm an expert. Assume that I'm pretty damn good at helping you think about things so you can come to a better answer, but there are no experts and there's no permanent answers. So secondly, yes, everything I give you with real life experience, with a framework, you know, something like the levels of the first principles or the levels of paradigms, test them before you accept them. But third, don't reject anything that I offer you without testing it and deeply working from it, because it gives you a chance to challenge your attachments, your certainty, but not to transfer it to me. So you're right. I mean, everything I'm even saying to you today, I couldn't have said it to you this clearly 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Heavens, I can't even remember, you know, exactly how I thought. And when we go after politicians because they change their mind, I keep thinking, what do we want? A nation full of people who are stuck at where they were when they were 20 or worse.
Exactly.
Younger. We well want said. Evolutionary capacity and the engagement that we have that allows us to evolve.
Agreed. You know, I think another interesting opportunity of the now is sort of reintroducing us to our extraordinary capacity to be in an evolutionary path as individuals. And that's the best news you could ever receive, that we're not stuck. We're not even linear. We are, in a given moment, potentialized to be completely radically transformed from the narrow notion we might have held just a moment ago. Something can spark an insight and a new understanding and a new perceiving that can literally happen that fast. And then you can apply it, as you say, and test it and see, does it ring true in a longer term reality?
If I look at who I am now, I mean, I am almost 80 years old, which is just shocking to me.
And you're beautiful.
I am. I agree. However, first, I didn't used to believe that I was smart. I used to believe very strongly that I was quite stupid. Because I'll tell you a little personal story here because it relates to how regeneration happens. I had a father who was pretty crippled psychologically about so many things, including that girls didn't have any intelligence whatsoever, and any thoughts we had had to be corralled and beaten out of us so that we wouldn't have wrong ideas. And he loved to punish me by putting me in a closet and locking the door. And I'm putting some of this in my new book because he'd leave me there for hours. Now that sounds absolutely horrible, but I want to tell you how much I learned sitting in those closets. I am claustrophobic, but I learned so much sitting in the closet, because the one thing he would say to me over and over again is, you're so stupid. And I'm writing a memoir called, or he'd say, you think you're smart, you're not. And I would say back to him as he closed that door and locked it with the key, I am too smart. And I didn't really quite believe that, but it took me until I sat in a few classrooms and I've written about three major teachers that disrupted that thought in me that I'm not smart and got me back to what I had felt that got me locked in the closet, which was that we are each unique beings. I had figured that out. And my father, the racist, thought there was nothing unique if your skin wasn't white and you weren't in our community. And somehow at a young age, that was in me, and it got rekindled, reawakened back to my essence and what my work is about. Bringing that concept into the world, I know. And so I'm now writing a memoir called I Am Too Smart.
And so are you, other.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Well,
we each have our own essence to rekindle. That was mine, to rekindle that each individual has something extraordinary and is not even tapped. And if I look at who I am now at this age, it's almost like I'm a completely different being than I was before I was 30 years old.
I relate to that on so many different levels. And it's interesting to me because, again, sort of going back to the good news that I like to reiterate, which is we are not fixed as beings, that even a person like your father holds as much capacity to evolve as anyone else does, whether or not that is chosen. That too is part of the free will reality that we all are gifted with, the right to choose. Whether we choose well or not is the next piece of that equation.
Well, and the really important thing I think here to add here is there's a capability involved in that. There is an act of will. I definitely believe that. But most of us haven't grown up having that thought. I mean, that's a weird thought, Celine. Totally weird, right? Which is that I could choose. And a lot of people think we don't have free will, but it's mostly because the capability is not built to see ourselves in that way. And sometimes I say you have to be in a community often to really grow all that. And I found communities who were working on growing people when I was in my 30s and built the capability to understand, what does it mean to choose? What am I choosing between? How does my mind even work in that process? How does my being character even come into play? How can I grow who I am, grow this belief in my intelligence? We mostly work on just skill-based development, learning how to do this, that, and the other. You're talking about the development of a whole being.
Right.
And I think then if we're graced enough to find a community or way, or sometimes parents, we get that capability and then we can make that choice.
I like the word capability. I'd like us to talk a little more about capability because I don't think it's a common word in the lexicon. Right. I think you just pointed out very astutely, you know, we're all very comfortable with the idea of attaining new skills. Mm-hmm. Skill sets is a compliment, you know, that's stacks, skill stacks. Right. But capability, let's say a little bit more about, you know, what is the essence of capability?
So I love frameworks, as you well know, because frameworks give us a way to be whole. And one of the frameworks that I think is really helpful here is will, being, and function. And we were both just referencing the idea of function, which is what we get taught in school, often what we become experts in, quote unquote, when we go to college. We've got an arena that we know how to do, and we continue to try and prove to others we can do better than them or at least do really well. Now, that's not the only way function can happen, but that's the one we're used to thinking about, and we call that ability, right? Mm. These are our abilities, our competencies. There's a second one called being, which has to do, and it is where my essence resides, but it also has to do with where my character resides and where the quality of energy that I can bring to things resides. And it is unstable in some sense. I mean, just think about when I would deal with my husband on some days, I would have an amazing state of being, but it was usually determined by what was outside of me and how he treated me. Same for him. I could upset him. I knew exactly how to set him off, and he knew how to set me off. But if, as I developed and he developed our being, we became people who could be self-managing in regard to the quality of energy, where we were, how we reacted, how we managed our ego. We had all of that capacity, which became who we were, not what we could do, which was the function, but who we were. And then the third thing is will. And will is the ability to access something much broader, bigger, more deep, defined, that can source us being able to manage our being. So for example, if I remember I exist in a family, that family exists in a community, that community exists in a nation, that nation exists in a geopolitical, on a planet, I suddenly have responsibility. The level of my will becomes enormous because I know that what I'm doing with my field that I'm tending here is affecting what's actually happening with global climate change. That's a different level of will, but you have to be able to see those nested processes, which is part of will. I also have to be able to see myself. I have to learn to be self-observing, set aims to grow myself, and then I work on that. And over time, while I work on that, my being becomes greater. Now I want different functional ableness. I want certain kinds of thinking capacity, which is a function thing. I want certain kinds of languaging, behavior, the ability to write. I knew nothing about how to write. And then I had one of my community leaders said to me, you must write because you think really well, but you're not articulating it well, and you will not learn to do that until you learn to write. And it took me 20 years to create a first book because I had so much to learn. All that was only sustained because of will, and boy, did it grow me and my character. So capability is the ability to access all each of those in the right way and timing on demand. That's what capability means. I can say, self, be present. And I can bring myself present. I can say, self, think of the right words functionally, and I work on the right words. I can say, self, remember you're not in all of this alone. You are in a nested system. You have stewardship for the evolving of the capacity of everything by the way you live. And now I am a completely different being, and that means I have the capability to exercise those on demand.
That is exquisite. Thank you. I like that. I mean, and so, you know, when I think about one of the phrases you use when you were sort of at the level of being and you talked about self-managing, you know, and I think maybe one of the most important elements in our culture at the moment is the need for us to become more focused on what it means to be self-managing.
Yeah.
How we are reacting or are we responding? Are we in a state of open receptivity or are we coming from a rigid fixed position? And so much of what I witness in our culture, particularly speaking specific to the United States, but I think it also could be applied to a larger geopolitical patterning, we've sort of let go of a value that, or a principle that where I come from matters. What I say, how I think, how I react or respond to another, that there is a value, an importance, a significance to that, that is actually, I'm going to use this word, sacred.
I
don't think the recognition of a almost like a sacred a contract with self is as prevalent as it needs to be.
So a framework comes to mind.
And
the framework is one I created some time ago called the 9 levels of self-determination. And I think I have this, if you ever want to go look it up in the CAD membership site recorded somewhere, we can help you find it. That, so the whole thing is called self-determining. Am I really determining my impacts, my effects, the outcomes I produce? Am I really, by being self-determining about me? So managing is one of those, but the very first one is really looking at being self-directed. Have I even set myself on the right kind of course?
Right.
And ask, what's my work to do? What's my direction? How well I know whether I'm going to get there? That's the very first one that most people don't do. The second one, I'm not going to remember all these right now, but the second one is self-sourcing. And I don't mean by that I'm the only one I listen to. I mean, I am in charge of what I'm sourcing and I'm in charge of what I'm not sourcing. And, you know, like I quit listening to the news some years ago because I felt like it didn't source my capacity to think. Now, I still know what's going on in the world. It's always amazing to me. But I'm sourcing from the kind of things that can help me figure out what would I teach, what would I bring based on my direction. Then you can get down to the bottom of the 9 and you get to self-regulating. So I can regulate my energy, my ups and downs. I can choose where I work, where I don't work. And ultimately, I can't remember the last one, but near the last is self-correcting. I can say, self, you are off course, either right this moment or have been for the last year. And so learning that those are all aspects of us becoming self-determining needs to be a childhood lesson or experiences from parents, from teachers, from grandparents. I got a lot of that from my grandparents, not from my parents, but from my paternal grandparents, who were a mess also, which is why my father was, but right. From my wonderful grandparents on my mother's side, I learned those 9, and that's how I ended up writing them. None of them ever said, here's the 9 self-determining categories, but I started watching and thought, what am I seeing that when I am most effective, I am in the most meaningful situations, I'm contributing the most, what's going on? And I came up with those 9.
Wonderful. Well, I'm grateful to you for doing that work on behalf of the greater whole of all of us.
My job.
Yes, right?
My job.
You know, I think people are daunted by what you just described. It sounds hard.
Yep.
It sounds like it takes a lot of time, takes a lot of effort. So what do you say to, you know, why would we bother? Why would anybody sort of take this mantle on? What are some of the motivations, stimulus, maybe, you know, I know we're not really into the reward and punishment model, but what would you say are, you know, why take this on as an individual? What's the value?
I think I would like to answer the question you asked and ask how would you go about it also, if you would like. Why do it is, Mary Oliver, I'm going to get this wrong, but she has this wonderful line in one of her poems, which says, what am I going to do with this one life? You know, I have one life, and even if there's karma, it's still, you know, we've got one being. And if we want a meaningful life, which most people say they do, and we want a contributing life, which most people say they do, we've got to build the capacity and the capability to carry that out. And that's probably the selfish reason, but it also, in some way, is why you got a life, why you got a body, why you get to go do stuff. And I always say to people, I assume that was the promise I made in order to get a body. Who knows? I made that up.
But I like that one.
Right. I think that there is something to be said for, I got this extraordinary opportunity, and I don't know how many more years I have of it, but I'm not going to stop because I now understand the richness. But there's one thing, the how, is I don't think individuals do this alone. I know the Buddha sat under a tree, but you know, everything that's been written later said that was a few days, not even quite a month. And then he went back into community and went to work on it because like he had an insight, oh, here's what I need to work on. But now how do I do that? I switched about 30 years ago to never working with individuals. You can't call me up and hire me as a coach, a mentor, any of those things. You have to be in a community. And there are some practical reasons, but the major one is you get a field and the energy is really different. And you get more. And you get, in some ways, an expansion of who you are. My most recent book, which will be out in March, if I can plug that, The Regenerative Life. The regenerative life is targeted at individuals who are in roles that are trying to answer the question you just asked. How in the world do we get the energy? And I did it as an action learning project where I had 100 people sign up and went through 6 months of learning how to think about their role from the kind of things we're talking about. And to keep a journal, to in some cases share and interact. We had business owners. We had people who are the host for Here and Now Public Radio, who she also wrote a foreword for the book. We had Jeffrey Hollander, who we just mentioned, but we also had teachers who were in education down to the bottom of the organization, bottom of the hierarchy, I mean. We had one school principal. We had parents. We had designers. We took 9 roles, which I believe that if communities were formed around them and people learned how to think about their role every day from that kind of perspective, it would change how they worked. And I'm creating communities out of all of them. One of them, Spirit Resource, you're in, right? That's what we called it. The CAD group was about Spirit Resource, but we're creating them on economic shapers as well as designers and parents. So I think the why we do it is because we have this one glorious life. That's what Mary Oliver said. What are we going to do with it? And you need to be in community to do that. And then you need to have the thinking capability that's necessary to be in that community to make it work. And they're lifelong communities, which is what CAD is and what every business leader I've ever worked with, I'm still connected to. Some of them don't pay me anything anymore, but they never go out of my life. And I think that's what we need, more of these lifelong communities.
I like that because that's, in essence, part of what would be healing of a lot of the distortion in our society presently is the isolation that's also very predominant.
Yeah.
Not knowing your neighbors, you know, we don't have more traditional gathering places like we did in the past. Churches are less well attended, synagogue, all of those things that were more part of where people found community. So it's also how do we create a context for coming together in the reality that we're in today?
And a developmental context, not networking. Not getting right. together and sharing stories, but in a process that matches the 7 first principles and those 9 self-determining things. We've got to be working developmentally in order to express our essence into the world with this one glorious life.
One glorious life. I like that. I think this is going to be where we'll close today as a chapter one, I'm hoping, and that you and I can do this again if you're willing.
Of course. I love this conversation.
Fantastic. Well, I do too. And I think this is a beautiful conversation that we'll be sharing in the month of December, because it's also a time of the longer nights, the shorter days, sort of a natural, more inward, retrospective opportunity for all of us to kind of think about what do we value? What's important? How do we align our life with those things in a more integrated and real way? And I think that this regenerative path is a beautiful way of accessing what's potentialized in being a person with one glorious life to express.
I agree. Could I invite people to go pay attention to, I have a podcast that is not interviews. It's more me, an opinion-based person, but it's full of the mixture of all of these. It's called
Absolutely.
Business. It's Business Second Opinion. And although it says it's about business, I have parents who are applying it to parenting and designers who are applying it to their own creative work. So I love having people come visit and then tell me what to talk about. And I do that.
Fantastic. I am so deeply grateful to you on so many different levels. Thank you so much for being a part of At the Epicenter's Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change. This has been a conversation with Carol Sanford, who is a senior fellow at the Social Innovation at, where are you?
Babson.
I know. Babson. Thank you. All right. Well, till next time, wishing all wellness in the world and in your lives. And again, thank you, Carol, so much for being a part of this conversation.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I've greatly enjoyed it.
Thank you.
The Regenerative Voices, Elevating Stories, Activating Change podcast series is produced by At the Epicenter, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. The podcast and video recordings are made possible by the generous support of people like you. Make a tax-deductible donation or sign up as a monthly supporter by visiting attheepicenter.com/donate. Support packages start at $1 per month. The podcast series is also sponsored by several corporate and organization sponsors. To become a podcast sponsor, visit attheepicenter.com/contact to let us know of your interest. If you found this podcast episode insightful and meaningful, please pass it on by sharing it with a friend or colleague who will also enjoy it. Thank you for tuning in, for your support, and for activating change.